This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some stories to tell. And we want to honor our veterans for their service, for the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And we're going to hear a multifaceted story today from a 93-year-old World War II veteran, a naval aviator during that period in our nation's history, and for more than 60 years, all the way back to 1950, a resident of Kingsburg, California. Kingsburg, California in the 1950s was an interesting place to be because of the Johnson brothers, Rafer and Jimmy Johnson, two of the greatest athletes ever out of California. Did you know they were good when they were coming through high school?
Oh, yeah. I knew Rafer was good before he got into high school. I knew the coach very well, and in fact, he was in the Kiwanis Club with me. I sat next to him one time, and he was doing very well in the eighth grade. So this is what the coach said. He said he told Rafer that if worked real hard all through high school, he says, you can have the decathlon someday.
Wow. Maybe that's what made him shoot for it.
Oh, I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
Well, Rafer was an unusual, just wonderful guy.
Silver medal in 1956 and gold medal in 1960 in the Olympic decathlon, and his younger brother Jimmy, an NFL Hall of Famer with the 49ers as a defensive back. And Kingsburg's still pretty proud of those brothers, huh?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, understandably so. The voice you hear is that of John Adams, not our second president. Your middle name isn't Quincy, is it?
Harvey.
Harvey, all right. Just checking. You ever think about running for president?
Not yet.
John Adams, Kingsburg, California, but originally Lindsay, California, a city that's a little bit southeast of where we are right now in Tulare County, famous for olives. People have picked those cans off their grocery store shelves, the Lindsay olives. But for you, growing up in the late 1920s and throughout the 30s, what was life like in Lindsay, California?
Excellent, as far as I was concerned. I was always very grateful to have lived through the Depression and also through the war. I thought my time was just at the perfect time. And the reason for the Depression, my gratitude there, I got to help my father and mother a little bit. I remember giving my mother a dollar, and I would mow lawns for 5 cents, 10 cents, and I had one lawn to take care of and a yard to take care of. I got 25 cents for that, and so I accumulated my money with this, and that I'd put in the pennies in a 22 gauge shell box. So I gave mother a dollar for groceries, and she took it. And actually, one time they were going hungry, but the kids never went hungry. And we found out that they were going a little bit hungry is because we always had breakfast at a certain time. And at noontime, 12 up, it was lunch. And at 6 o'clock in the evening, supper. And we all sat down together. But here was a time where mother and dad prepared the dinner for us, and they didn't sit down with us. They said that they were busy in the kitchen, and this was very strange. So we ate our dinner, and what we didn't care for, we were taught to clean everything up, but they weren't there, and we left scraps. And so they came out and took them back into the kitchen to wash the dishes. And my sister was very inquisitive, and because it was her job to wash dishes, and she was a little older than I. And so she went outside and looked through the kitchen window, and here they were eating our scraps. And that's how we knew that they weren't getting enough food, you know. But they, outside of that, we never knew it.
To fully paint that picture for those listening, you were one of six children. One of those children died pretty young. So at that time, there's five children in your home.
Five, yeah.
And your parents are making sure you eat, but they were going without food themselves.
Well, for a little bit, because our scraps weren't very much.
And it sounds like that made a pretty strong impression on you.
Still with me.
Yeah. What did that teach you? I mean, is that something that helps you understand what really matters? Is it a lesson about unconditional love or sacrifice? Or what was the value that you took from that going forward?
I don't think I ever tried to analyze it very closely. Just I remembered it, and of course, as you get older, it really becomes an item.
And I imagine, again, most people listening didn't live through this time, but that's what was happening in your own home. I'm sure you saw evidence of this depression throughout your community as well.
Yes, but not food-wise. And, you know, they all had the same problem, I'm sure of that. A lot of people were moving. We had neighbors moving. And so I asked Dad, when are we going to move? And he says, well, just one of these days or something like that. And anyway, finally, about a year later, we moved. He was an olive grower and an orange grower. He had lost the orange grove and another olive grove the first time, and we moved off the place. We moved about a half a mile away into a house that was our neighbor's. And then while we were there, he lost the second, the 20 acres that he planted of olives, and that was gone. So he was fortunate. I don't think it was a year later, he got a job to superintend the local cemetery, the Lindsay Strathmore Cemetery. And that's where we all grew up. We were fortunate enough for him to have that job because we kids got to help him. I think we could make just a few dollars a month.
So the first thing you mentioned when I asked you about the depression was mowing lawns for a nickel or a dime and contributing to the groceries for your family to keep food on the table.
$1.
But you had to mow 15, 20 lawns to get that dollar. And what I wanted to point out is here in 2015, we hear a kid's mowing lawns. And while it's always hard work and young men doing that today are admirable, I have a feeling that the lawnmower you were using is not something like the gas-powered or electric ones we know today.
Right. Push mower.
Push mower. No power whatsoever other than your elbow grease.
Right.
There's some teenagers listening right now who are saying, push mower? What in the world's a push mower? I've never heard of such a thing. Well, sharpen your blades and get out there, young people. So that's your childhood, and you had your three brothers and your one sister, and then you go to high school at Lindsay High School. Graduated when?
1940.
1940. And what are you thinking you're going to do with your life?
I wanted to join the Army Air Corps from, I think, sophomore year in high school.
Where did that come from?
That came from a YMCA camp at Lake Sequoia. My camp teacher went into the Army Air Corps, and I thought, that's for me. And I took an airplane ride one time when the parents were at church. I couldn't go because I had impetigo all over my face. In those days, you didn't see airplanes flying over. So here was an airplane flying over Lindsay. It was landing on the other side of Lindsay. It's obviously he was picking up passengers. It was in a field. I got on my bicycle and I went over there. I thought, well, I'm going to do this. And I didn't have my camera, so I bicycled back home and got my camera. And so $1, he took me for a flight down to Strathmore and back. So I was going to fly. I was going to go into aviation after that.
Just that one time. That's the first time you've ever been up in the air.
Yeah.
But you caught the bug.
Oh, yeah. I really did.
And for people who aren't familiar with the geography of the Central Valley, you said to Strathmore and back. That's not very far.
4 miles.
4 miles. Yeah, very close by. Strathmore would have been your arch rival in high school.
Yeah.
So from that point on, you had this desire. Mm-hmm. Then what'd you do about it?
Well, I needed 2 years to get into the Air Corps at that time.
This is before World War II has begun for America.
Right. But the Air Corps was for me because my mentor was an Air Corps man. He was killed shortly before I was ready to go in.
What happened?
Airplane.
An accident.
Yeah. And then my best friend was in the Navy, and he was stationed aboard the battleship Arizona.
And I want to get to that, but I want to ask you something. Sorry to interrupt. The whole reason you got interested in airplanes was this mentor you described, someone who you had been around at camp and made an impression on you. You catch the flying bug. Then before you've had a chance to pursue it, you find out he's been killed in an airplane accident. Did that discourage you at all from your aviation dreams?
Oh, no.
Not at all?
Not at all.
Didn't make you think twice?
Oh, no.
Uh-huh.
No, that's what I wanted to do.
And so you mentioned your friend, best friend from Lindsay, who was on the USS Arizona, and we'll hear that whole story, but what was his name?
Harvey Sanderson.
Harvey Sanderson.
Mm-hmm.
And was he one of the reasons you got into the Navy?
No, I don't think so. It might have been a subconscious reason.
How did that happen?
I finished 1 year of college. Oh, I signed up for the CPT program, which was a government program for pilots.
Civilian pilot training.
Civilian pilot training. By the time when they got into the secondary, the war started. So I wanted to get in as soon as I could, and I wanted to go to the Pacific. I changed from the Army Air Corps thinking to the Navy Air Corps because I had a lot more chance of being sent to the Pacific than I did to Europe.
And we're going to explore that more and also learn about Harvey Sanderson and the USS Arizona Band in a little bit. But there's another aspect of this that I don't want to leave out because I've interviewed a lot of people who lived on the West Coast at that time, especially in agricultural areas like where you were in Tulare County. There were Japanese Americans who, after the attack on Pearl Harbor and after Executive Order 9066 a couple months later, they were forced from their homes into internment camps. Is that something that you saw happening there in Lindsay?
That's a shame.
Did you have some friends that happened?
Oh, sure.
To?
Oh, sure. I was driving a school bus for Vitalia Junior College, and we had three Japanese aboard. I've forgotten her name temporarily, but Oku was her last name. She was just a beautiful, wonderful girl. And see, the Japanese, they never got into trouble. And when they got home, they all had to work. And one thing they did, when they weren't connected with school activities, then they were home. They didn't join any other clubs or anything. So they stayed separated, and they all worked very hard, and they were all just had perfect records, really.
So you'd grown up your whole life going to school with Japanese Americans.
Oh, sure.
And then you're out of high school, and before you end up as a Navy pilot, you're driving this school bus, and then all of a sudden they're gone? Or what?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because that's the reason I didn't finish my story there.
Yeah.
So we were all wondering what's going to happen to them, and it was a big question mark. And then all of a sudden, the next day, they weren't aboard the bus. And they were gone. And the last time she was aboard the bus, she sat right over there. And before she got out, I asked her, what's happening? And she said, we don't know yet. But when she got home, she found out. And so they just moved out. And there were lots of us who felt that was wrong. But what do I know about it? Well, in our history, that was a black spot in our history. It just definitely was.
But it sounds like you certainly empathize with what they went through and have respect for their patriotism.
Yes.
Throughout that.
Yes. Yeah. And Japanese friend told me this afterwards. He said the very same things that I just told you, that the war made them join clubs. In other words, come in and be a part of the civilian life.
And, of course, in between, while these families endured the war imprisoned in the internment camps, so many young men volunteered to fight for the very country that had locked them up. We've heard from members of the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the Gopher Broke Unit here on Hometown Heroes, as well as others who served in the Pacific in the MIS, the Military Intelligence Service. And, of course, all Nisei veterans were honored just a few years ago with the Congressional Gold Medal. It's good to get Mr. Adams' perspective on that situation, and we'll get more of his point of view when we come back, including a better picture of his high school best friend who remains entombed on the USS Arizona. John Adams has thought about Harvey Sanderson and visits to Pearl Harbor and also at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., which he says should be a must-see for all Americans. That's especially true for our remaining World War II vets. And as we approach the break here, a little more about an organization that makes those kind of visits possible. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is a 93-year-old World War II veteran who served as a pilot in the U.S. Navy for 4 years, John Adams of Kingsburg, California, a native of Lindsay, California, which is famously home to the world's biggest olive, but also home to one of the more than 2,400 Americans who died at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, musician second class James Harvey Sanderson. He had been Mr. Adams' best friend at Lindsay High School. And I think it would give us all a little perspective to learn a little more. What can you tell us about him, the kind of person he was, why you guys were such great friends throughout high school?
Well, I developed an interest in good music, and he was a musician. As a matter of fact, when he was in high school, we were fortunate enough to have Hugo Flock as the instructor, and he was a German music instructor from Visalia, and he was a chicken farmer. So every day he would go to the Lindsay schools, and he started me in music. I think it was in the third or fourth grade.
What'd you play?
Clarinet.
Clarinet. All right.
And Harvey was a clarinetist. Harvey went to the state. It was a group of high schools, musicians, going in this particular case, I think San Francisco.
It was like some kind of state honor band or
that's
something?
That's it, yeah. Yeah. And Harvey got first place 2 years in a row.
So he's the best high school clarinetist in the state.
Yes, right. Then he joined the Navy, and I went to the Navy School of Music, and he got into a Navy band, and he was aboard Arizona when I was in Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. So December 7th, 1941, you're back here in California.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find out about what happened at Pearl Harbor?
See, that was on a Sunday, as I recall. I was, we'd just gotten home from church. I was sitting in the living room listening to the news, and they interrupted what was going on to announce that Pearl Harbor had just been bombed. So, of course, we didn't know what the damage was, and that's the first I'd heard of it.
Did you know that that's where Harvey was?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, Harvey was home about a month before, and he said they were going to Pearl Harbor. And unfortunately, his father died about a week before, or just a few days before Pearl Harbor. And had she sent a message to the Navy, they would have sent him home.
Wow.
But she didn't, and I remember her telling me, she says, no, he was home just a month ago, and, you know, don't bother him. And so that's the way that turned out, and she had to live with that the rest of her days.
Yeah, so heavy.
Yeah.
How much were you able to learn about what he'd been doing before the attack and or where he was when it happened? Did you get any kind of insight into what happened to him?
Well, I do know his station, his battle station was in the ammunition down below, handling ammunition, passing ammunition. So that's where he would be.
Which would have left him virtually zero chance at survival.
Oh, yeah.
When the Arizona was hit.
Mm-hmm.
But was it the night before he'd been performing a concert with the band there?
Yeah, in Honolulu.
Uh-huh.
And a mutual friend of ours and grew up with us and was in the Navy in Pearl Harbor. He went to this band concert in Honolulu the night before. And after the concert, he talked with Harvey. And then the next morning, he was gone.
Wow. I'm really glad you shared that because I think it's important for people to understand that when we get to December 7th every year and we talk about it, it's not just ships going up in flames. It's not just a number, more than 2,000 sailors who died that day. It's real people. It was your best friend who died that day. In the years since, have you been to the USS Arizona Memorial?
Yes. Yeah.
What was that like for you? What did you think about while you were there?
Oh, I don't think I can tell you. I don't think I could put it into words. I was in the Navy at the time, and this was during the war, and the Arizona was on the bottom, but they'd put a plank, 2-inch by 12-inch planks, out to the ship, which was not very far. So I got aboard the Arizona, that part of it, and then that's all I saw.
So you walked out on those planks, and you're standing basically right above this sunken ship, and you know that your friend is still down there.
Yes.
And you made a statement earlier. You said the reason you chose flying for the Navy as opposed to the Air Corps was it is a greater chance of seeing action in the Pacific. In the Air Corps, just as likely to end up flying over Europe.
Oh, yes.
But in the Navy Air Corps, you're going to be most likely out there in the Pacific.
It worked out that way.
And it did. I want to make sure I'm clear. Are you saying that's because of what happened to Harvey? And that the enemy who did that to your best friend was the one that you wanted to fight?
I would have to say probably yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That must have had the influence.
So you were there during the war while the Arizona was still there, but the memorial had not been built yet.
No.
And now if you go there today, you take a boat out to this memorial, you can still see those tears, as they call them, tears of the Arizona, the drops of oil that bubble to the surface.
Right.
But you also see in beautiful white marble, I believe it is, the names of all the guys who died.
Yeah, I've been there.
You've seen Harvey's name on that wall?
Oh, yes, sure.
So, again, I know it's hard to even think about, and you said you couldn't put into words what it felt like during the war, but contrasting those two experiences, having been there while everything's fresh and been there more recently when America has built this memorial to honor people like your friend. How did that feel going back there and seeing the way it's preserved now and the way, hopefully, that legacy is maintained?
Oh, I was very happy about that, the way it's built. You know.
I hope I'm not belaboring the point here as we dwell on this part of it, but I want people to feel what you felt back then. And there was some power that arose in America at that time. They talked about awakening the sleeping giant, and posters were everywhere with a tattered flag saying, "Remember Pearl Harbor." And the song was on the radio, "Remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory." And a lot of guys that I've talked to were motivated by that.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess maybe it's a hard question to answer. I guess what I wonder was, having such a personal connection to what happened there, was that motivation maybe more palpable for you because of Harvey?
Oh, I think it had an influence. I signed up for the Navy, I think it was in January of 42.
So only about a month after Harvey's death. And we're going to hear about some of the unique experiences you would eventually have. But first, I do want to add a little more background on that USS Arizona band that your friend Harvey was a part of, and from what I can tell, a major part of. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a photo of the band taken 2 weeks before the Pearl Harbor attacks. Harvey is right up front with a saxophone in his hands. That was his secondary instrument behind the clarinet. He's right next to the band leader, musician first class Frederick Kinney. The band had been engaged in an ongoing competition called the Battle of Music, in which they matched up against the bands from other ships. The final round of that competition was scheduled for December 20th, but it would be canceled after the Arizona band became the only Navy band ever to be formed together, train together, go aboard ship together, fight together, and die together. After the attack, the other bands decided to award the grand prize trophy posthumously to the Arizona band, and that's something you'll learn if you ever have the privilege of visiting the USS Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor. You'll also see the name J.H. Sanderson on the wall, as we discussed. For about 40 years after Pearl Harbor, there was a persistent myth that was actually perpetuated at the Arizona Memorial itself, a myth that all 21 members of the band died in their sleep on that Sunday morning. The truth is that when General Quarters sounded, they snapped to their battle stations, as Mr. Adams said, below deck, passing ammunition up for the Arizona's guns to fire at the enemy. They kept carrying out that duty until a Japanese bomb made the Arizona's magazine explode, killing the band and approximately 1,000 others in an instant. You'll find a link to more detailed information on that at hometownheroesradio.com, but I wanted to at least share a little bit of it here and add to our picture of John Adams' best friend, Harvey Sanderson. You said his fate helped point you in the direction of the Navy and the war in the Pacific. Did you have an idea of what you wanted to do, or a plane that you wanted to fly, or the kinds of duties that you wanted to have?
The only thing I wanted to do was a multi-engine, and so I got into it. They had two airplanes. One was the B-25. They had a squadron of those. But the other one was PBY. But the only twin engine they had in Corpus Christi was the PBY. So I trained in the PBY.
A flying boat, the Catalina. And
right.
It would have been hard to see one of those around Lindsay growing up, huh? Not enough water for a PBY around there. You mentioned the training. Was that difficult? Was that dangerous? Was that challenging, the training you went through?
I couldn't say that it was dangerous. I didn't even think about that. I did what I was told. Well, I think the challenges were a daily in the cadet life. There was just daily. I was just so grateful that I was there because of the future that it offered. Then when I got my wings, why, I was just, I can't tell you how grateful I was.
As for that aircraft, the PBY Catalina, what was that like to fly?
That was wonderful because that had two engines, and I liked that, and what was in my mind was probably commercial aviation for a future.
And I'm just guessing that your training consisted of water takeoffs and landings?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Which is not the same as taking off and landing on terra firma.
Quite different.
Explain that to us. What is different about it?
The main difference is you have a lot of drag in the water when your hull hits and touches the water. It's very smooth if the water is smooth, but when the water is rough, then it's very, very rough. So when it touches the water, well, then there's so much drag on the bottom why you have to come back on the stick, and you slow down in a hurry, of course. But I just enjoyed it very much. And of course, we had a PBY-2, I guess we called it, and that had wheels, so we got to land on the runways also.
Mm-hmm. So you were a pretty versatile pilot by this time, and I'm sure you were envisioning heading out to the Pacific and maybe flying around searching for downed bomber crews or something?
Well, whatever they had for me.
What did they have for you?
Well, actually, they had a new airplane called the PBM made by Martin. That was a real fine airplane, it turned out to be. But I graduated from Corpus Christi on the last day of the year. I was on my way to Norfolk, Virginia to go into PBMs. When I got there, I found out that everybody was grounded because the PBMs were having severe trouble blowing up on takeoff, and so those were grounded. Anyway, when they were accumulating pilots very rapidly, they're coming from three training bases. It was Corpus Christi and Pensacola and Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on for a week or two. And so every facility needed more pilots. And the admiral from the primary training command in Kansas City flew in one day, and he went from A to R down the alphabet and took all of those, and I was Adams. So I became a primary instructor, much to my disappointment.
You wanted to get over there into the war zone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they said, no, we need you here to train some more guys.
Yeah. And that was a real disappointment.
There's so many questions I have for you. One, let's talk about this thing with the PBMs, because you stated it very matter-of-factly, but if people were listening closely enough, they probably had their eyes open a second. You said when you get to Norfolk, the reason pilots are grounded was the PBMs were blowing up mm-hmm. on takeoff,
yeah.
as in exploding mm-hmm. with everyone on board
dying.
That's
how I heard the news, anyway. And they found the problem in the design between the tanks and the hull. They had solid piping
mm-hmm.
from one tank to the other instead of flexible. The hull itself had a lot of bending in it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't take only a few fractions of an inch. So the leakage would start there at one of those connections. And then drip, and they didn't know it, of course. And gas would go down to the hull and bottom of the plane, and then eventually the fumes would get up to where there was a spark someplace, like throwing a switch there in the cockpit.
Yeah.
And that's what happened.
And I don't want to be morbid here, but the upshot of this is quite a few guys were losing their lives mm-hmm. because of a design flaw, basically.
Right. And I don't know how many planes they lost because of that.
But timing is everything.
Mm-hmm.
If you were there a couple weeks earlier, you might have been one of those guys blew up in a PBM.
Right. Yeah, well, Roberts, who was my roommate and going through cadets, he was R, so they didn't take him. It just went from A to R. And so he was very fortunate to have stayed, I thought. And he thought he was too, and he was ribbing me about becoming an instructor for the primary. Not too many months later, the same thing happened to him in San Francisco Bay. And that's all I know. And I thought it was taken care of, but maybe something else happened.
So here, you're disappointed to be stuck in the States training other guys.
Yeah.
He's excited that he's going to get a chance to
mm-hmm.
go fly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you're envious of his position
yeah.
until he's killed.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stories that we hear on this program are guys that were, you know, in a war zone. Maybe they were on the ground getting shelled by 88s in Europe, or, you know, they were flying fighter planes or bomber planes in combat against the enemy. And to this point, you haven't shared any of those kind of stories, but you're also talking about some of the lives that were lost in this war. And when mm-hmm. we talk of over 406,000 Americans who died in World War II, I don't think people think about or realize how many died just trying to figure out how all this equipment was going to work.
Mm-hmm.
The training deaths.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if that were happening today, I wonder what the climate would be, what the publicity would be.
Well, during war, there's no publicity, very little. So it's highly restrictive. So that's a good question that you asked, and how would the civilian population react? Of course, the civilian population was gung-ho all the way.
Mm.
See?
Different.
Entirely different. You could just feel it. It was an amazing time. It really was.
So for you, I mean, for instance, here you are, you've got your wings, you're wearing this Navy uniform, and you know that you've got two other brothers in the service, and then your other brother and your other sister and your parents are all behind you,
mm-hmm.
all wanting the same thing.
My sister did. She joined the WACS.
Did she?
Yeah, and a brother joined the Navy, and the youngest brother got into the Army, but everything was over by that time.
Well, and again, that's something that's very different from today's world, where people maybe don't understand how universal this was, how united our country was. So I'm glad you're sharing that. But for you, when you hear of the plane that you're supposed to be flying exploding on takeoff, when you find out your buddy Roberts, who you thought had the plum job, is killed because of an incident with his airplane, does any of that make you wonder about what you're doing and if this is dangerous work and if maybe your life's in danger?
I'm sure it did to some extent, but I can't elaborate on that, though.
And what about that duty? Because this was important duty, too, as an instructor. Because these young men, these cadets, their lives are, in a way, in your hand and the instruction you give them, right?
Yeah.
So did you get to the point where you actually enjoyed that or found some fulfillment in the training?
I was so disappointed when I got the orders to Bunker Hill, Indiana. I went to the superintendent of aviation training and asked him how I could get out of there, transfer out of there. And he said, there is only one way I know, or something like that. He said, that is, you're going to get orders after I leave. And he says, your job is to do your job and do it the best you can. And I said, yes, sir. And I did. And I never lost a student.
Hmm. That's something to be proud of. And eventually, you would get your wish and make your way to the Pacific. When we come back, we're going to find out how the missions Mr. Adams flew contributed in a very unique way to saving American lives. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and what has turned out to be a fairly philosophical episode today with a remarkable man, John Adams of Kingsburg, California. He's 93 years old now, but has some serious energy and serious ingenuity. If you have the privilege of shaking his hand someday, maybe you can ask him about some of his patents, like one for a ratchet pipe cutter. Or maybe you can have him demonstrate how he turns exquisite plates and other treasures on his wood lathe. We've heard about his youth in Lindsay, California, the admiration he had for two men who died while serving our country, and the disappointment he felt when, after earning his wings as a naval pilot, he was assigned to training other pilots in Indiana for a year and a half. When those 18 months were up, though, you did get into the Pacific Theater with the Naval Air Transport Service. You'd flown PBYs and PBMs, but what did you end up flying in the Pacific, and what was it you were transporting?
And they called them R5Ds, and that was a four-engine Douglas, and that's called a 54.
C-54.
Yeah. You transported everything. See, I was sent to Hawaii, so we flew across the Pacific out west and then back to Oakland, California, every other trip. So going west, the load was usually blood plasma and whole blood, or both, or one or the other. And then coming back to California, we had people, soldiers.
So you're flying this big transport plane, and when you're flying from the West Coast out to the Pacific, your entire cargo, and this is a big plane that can hold a lot, but your entire load was whole blood and blood plasma.
Yeah, it was blood plasma at first, and then they developed a way to keep whole blood long enough. And when we had that aboard, that took priority. In other words, we couldn't sit on the ground.
Yeah, you had some urgency, because otherwise your whole cargo is going to be spoiled, and what's the point?
Right.
I know you are anticipating facing this enemy out there somewhere, but when you think back on that duty alone of bringing blood and plasma to the Pacific, where the reality is wounded soldiers and airmen and Marines needed it to save their lives, right? I mean, that's the idea.
Mm-hmm.
How much pride does that give you in what you were able to do? And the duty that you carried out. Because really, people think about war and there's a lot of death and destruction, but that job was saving lives, wasn't it?
Right.
If you don't get it there, guys are going to die.
The only thing I can say about that is I was amazed when I was reading or told, I don't know where the story came from, but it was authentic, that the government had ordered just a lot more caskets than they ever used. And that was the reason, because of the blood. Well, my feelings about it, I can't answer that.
But I want everybody to hear this. What you just said was that the government estimates of how many caskets would be needed to meet mm-hmm. the demand in terms of casualties, there were a lot of leftover caskets at the end mm-hmm. because the blood that you helped transport to the war zone saved that many lives. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty unique duty, isn't it, to have that privilege of transporting that cargo?
Well, I do know that I was happy to be in a transport division.
Mm-hmm.
I like that work. I spent very, very few days unhappy in 4 years of Navy.
Mm. So when you're flying west, you're taking these life-saving materials, but when you're flying back east from the Pacific back to California, you said you were transporting people.
Personnel.
Was it people who had been wounded?
A few times, yeah. But we never, I didn't get any hospital flights. I was looking forward to that, but I never got one.
You know, I've interviewed tons of pilots on this program, fighter pilots, bomber pilots. I've had fighter pilots say, you know, I'm glad it was only me in the plane, that I only had to be responsible for myself. I've had bomber pilots say, boy, I felt a heavy burden for a 10-man crew, that all those lives are in my hands. What did you feel on a C-54 full of guys who were trying to get out of the war and go home?
Where they had been didn't make it any, but you always feel that responsibility, of course, when you're flying passengers. I came home as a passenger from Hawaii to Oakland and sat in a bucket seat. And that's an interesting story. I sat right next to the first prisoner of war from the Pacific that was released to come home from the Philippines. And he was a dentist in the Navy, and he'd spent 4 years as a prisoner of war of Japanese. He was telling about it, and he would, this sounds funny that I use this as an illustration, he's like a coffee pot perking. He'd perk a little bit, and it'd be silence. Then he'd perk a little bit, and silence, telling me what he went through. And it was unbelievable.
Mm.
It's just unbelievable.
And I imagine just sitting next to him and seeing the physical shape he was in had to be eye-opening.
Yeah, he had said a few things that shook me. It was a shaking experience. And then after saying that, he said, I know I'm not right. And he was a dentist, so he was highly educated. But he was saying some things that he didn't even want to believe, but they were there.
Things that had happened to him.
Oh, yeah.
Things that the Japanese had done to him.
Yeah, him and the others. He was from Cabanatuan.
Well, and that Cabanatuan was the camp where there was a daring American raid to free prisoners from that camp. In fact, a movie was made a few years ago called The Great Raid. Was he one who was freed in that raid?
Yeah.
When you're listening to that and you're seeing this man and you're grasping what he went through for 4 years, what's your response? What happens inside of you as you process that?
I was dumbfounded.
Hard to believe.
Oh, sure.
Is there part of you that says, man, that could have been me?
Oh, sure.
It just strikes me. Here, the start of the war, your best friend dies at Pearl Harbor. Now here toward the end of the war, you're sitting elbow to elbow with a guy who was tortured and beaten and saw others executed in a brutal Japanese prisoner of war camp. Sure sounds like you came face to face with some pretty intense examples of the price of that victory in World War II and those who paid the price.
Well, I think we probably, most of us, you know, met someone.
mm-hmm. What gives you the most satisfaction or pride with regard to the years that you spent in the Navy and the things you did?
I was fortunate enough to be in. That's it. I would have been terribly unhappy had I not been able to go.
Why was that so important to you?
Well, I guess because of my mentor, Paul Bunch. Paul had everything. He was an athlete, and he was intelligent. He had gotten his degree from San Jose State, and then he got another degree at Cal. He could do anything body-wise or anything mentally. He was sharp.
Mm-hmm.
He was a leader.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm listening to what you say about Paul Bunch. and what you shared about Harvey Sanderson, someone else who obviously was very talented in the musical realm. Mm-hmm. And both of those guys died during World War II. Mm-hmm. And you tied that together with your opportunity to serve and how important that was for you. Are you saying that you felt a responsibility to do something with your own opportunity, your own life, knowing that those two very talented and two guys who had so much to give that their lives were cut short?
It's just you never forget your friendship with them and what they taught you and what you learned from them. I don't think Harvey would go along with what he taught me, but he did, of course. Everybody teaches. We're all teachers, and we're all students in varying degrees.
Very true. Have you ever found yourself wondering, had those guys lived? Had they survived the war? What kind of lives they might have had?
I'm pretty sure I thought that. I wish they had, but here I'm 93, and a lot of wishes have been forgotten.
Was there ever a time? I mean, you were in from very early on in the war to the end. Was there ever a time during those years in the Navy where you felt scared or you wondered if you were going to survive?
I don't remember. What I remember, it was all good remembering. I think that's well stated. Just to this day, I'm grateful that I was old enough to be in the war and to serve there, and I've always been grateful for that.
I know I've asked you a lot of questions, but before I forget, I do want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for that example you set. Thank you for telling us a lot about it. When you think back on it now, and like you said, you're 93, be 94 in October. I know you've got 6 kids and 9 grandkids. What are you most thankful for when you think of 93 years?
I think, and I'm asking myself, I want to be as honest as I can. I thank my relationship with my Lord Jesus Christ. And I use Paul Bunch as a mentor, but Christ is my mentor, a real mentor, because he's always with me. When I was age 17, I accepted Christ as my Savior.
Is that something that colored your perspective during your years in the Navy? That maybe you dealt with the things that happened differently because of that?
Oh, I'm sure I did. It guided me where to go and where not to go, what to do and what not to do. It had an influence there for sure.
Are you saying that specifically with relation to the Navy or in life in general?
Life in general. It's still that way.
Last question. Again, myself included, most people listening to this were not alive in World War II. What do you think the rest of us need to know and remember about what you and everyone else alive in America at that time were able to accomplish?
That's an easy one. I think the most important part of my growing up was the Depression. I feel this way. I feel it frequently. Well, what these young people needed was a Depression.
So they wouldn't take anything for granted?
Right.
Sounds like you haven't taken anything for granted in a long time.
Why should I?
Indeed. And why should the rest of us, especially after a taste of this World War II veteran's perspective today? Remember to head to hometownheroesradio.com for more background information on John's late friend Harvey Sanderson and the USS Arizona Band. And you'll also find then and now photos of this 93-year-old Navy veteran straight out of the program from a great event last weekend in Visalia, California, which raised $12,000 for Honor Flight and will make it possible for more World War II veterans to see their memorial. Well done, Visalia Veterans Committee. We're out of time on today's program. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.